In 1948, Lena Prokofiev, the former wife of composer Sergei Prokofiev, was taken from her home in Moscow and sent to a Soviet gulag. She spent the better part of a decade being moved from one prison to another, her appeals falling on indifferent or deaf ears. When she was finally released, she refused to talk about her incarceration, and her story went untold for decades. Simon Morrison has pieced together a portrait of what her times with Serge and in the prison system were like in his latest book called Lena and Serge, The Love Wars of Lena Prokofiev. It is published by Houghton Mifflin. I'm very pleased it has brought Simon Morrison to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
So you'd already written about Sergei Prokofiev. Was that when you first became interested in learning more about Lena's story?
Yeah, absolutely. I've spent about 15 years working on the music of the composer, and I know his diaries and his various letters. But one of the things I was struck by was the fact that he had this, you know, ostensibly really stormy relationship with this lady, and they had two children together, but he didn't have much to say about the nature of their relationship, and he had nothing to say about the fact that she disappeared for 8 years.
And is there much in the public record that you could draw upon?
No. Gulag records are, by definition, hard to locate. In many regards, they're still illegal to locate unless you're a distant relative and you can prove your identity. And records of arrests, likewise, are hard to trace. And in fact, many of the people who were arrested in the Soviet sphere, their personal records, anything associated with them, was destroyed automatically because they were considered to be enemies of the people, so to speak.
You drew upon letters and diaries. How did you gain access to them?
I actually wrote a little article about Lena's New York City, Brooklyn upbringing. And that article so pleased Prokofiev's older son that he actually said, you know, my mother always wanted to tell her story, and she was never able to do so because of, you know, memory lapses and because of the trauma associated with what she went through. And he said, why don't you do a book about her? And he opened up the Russian archives for me, which were materials that are not even on the books, not even in the catalogs. And then from there, I began to build the story. And the big problem I had, however, was these documents, these letters between Serge and Lena didn't actually detail her arrest and incarceration. And so for that later section of the book, I had to rely on materials that he had in home and, in fact, didn't know. And so there were these personal, very deeply traumatic gulag materials that became available to me after he himself had died.
She wrote things to her family.
Yeah, she wrote letters, and her two sons wrote to her in the camps.
Because she, as you, I said earlier, she didn't talk about what had gone on during those years after she came out of the gulag because of the trauma. A lot of people don't want to talk about their war experiences, for example.
Yeah, it was trauma. It was something she obviously wanted to forget, and it was also illegal. Soviet citizens were required to actually sign an oath that they wouldn't speak about their experiences after their release.
Even years after Stalin died? She lived into the late 1980s.
She did, but she left the camps 3 years after Stalin was dead, but still had to sign that oath, and that oath remained in practice through the Brezhnev era up to Perestroika.
Now, she wasn't Russian. Where was Carolina Kvitina born?
She was born in Barcelona.
And then the family moved to Brooklyn?
Yeah, this is a wonderful story. She's the child of traveling musicians. Spanish father, Russian descended mother. Both of them were, you know, excellent singers. Her father taught music theory and a little guitar, and they traveled around Europe. They lived for a while in Switzerland, and they ended up, because they had a contact here in New York, an adjunct professor at Columbia, they ended up settling in Brooklyn to try and make it here in the music business.
On Rodney Street in Williamsburg.
Exactly.
So she must have spoken a number of languages. Her parents had two different languages, and then English.
Yeah, she ended up with five under her belt, and the weakest was Spanish, actually. She learned Italian because she lived in Italy. And what's amazing is we have recordings of her giving interviews in which she would quote in various languages, and it was just unaccented. She just had this incredible gift for language.
On the other hand, we don't have recordings of her singing, even though she was well-known during the better part of her career?
No, we believe that, and this is me and the composer's grandson, we believe that those recordings were destroyed by the secret police after her arrest because she was persona non grata and needed to be erased from, you know, existence.
Do we know how good she was?
She was a lovely chamber singer, and she did some really complicated repertoire, so she had good interpretive skills. She performed Gilda in Rigoletto, which is, you know, no slouch as a role goes in Milan. But I think that she had some problems with intonation, tuning, and she did confess, and Prokofiev noticed that she did suffer occasionally from terrible stage fright. So I think she perhaps would have been, you know, a more prominent chamber singer had she had the opportunity, and certainly a great teacher.
How did she meet Prokofiev?
Through a connection in the Russian community here in New York. She met him in 1919 after a performance and was whisked into the green room by this contact, and he laid his eyes on her and she sort of shied away, and then they had another opportunity to meet through this mutual friend out on Staten Island.
Now, he was already famous, but he wasn't living in Russia. He had left with the consent of the authorities?
Yeah, he left just after the revolution took place, and he had the imprimatur of the sort of head of cultural education to actually leave and make his fortune in the West and be a good, you know, Soviet or communist ambassador. And that's actually a duty that he fulfilled. So he was never, it's always discussed as why did he return to Russia in 1936, but in many respects he never left.
He saw his job as being a goodwill ambassador. At the same time, of course, he was living the good life outside of Russia.
Exactly.
Now, were they a love match, or were they also an artistic match?
I think that they had passion in common for one another. I think it was a stormy emotional relationship. Artistically, she actually was hesitant about going into singing, and he encouraged her to do that so that she would have, you know, what he called a métier, a sort of profession for herself. So I think it was hesitant on her part. She certainly was interested in being associated with him and being part of his celebrity, and in fact assisting him. Perhaps being his manager or assisting him in, you know, some of the artistic pursuits, but not specifically in performing.
They traveled all over the world before he returned to Russia?
Pretty much. You know, there were certain places they didn't go. But
they were in Paris?
Yeah, they went to Cuba. They went throughout continental Europe. They went to the south. You know, he went to Morocco, certainly Eastern Europe a lot, and then all over Russia.
And then, as you said, he decided to return. How did she feel about that?
This is the most fascinating story. She had a lot of trepidation, and she was very fearful. But at the same time, I think she realized that the marriage, which was, you know, on the rocks at various points in time, in order for it to survive, she needed to actually go along with this desire of his.
Well, if she's returning to a Russia that is in serious turmoil, 1936 or so, you have show trials, you have purges, you have all sorts of problems. Did that affect their lives at all?
It did. First, she was scared to go back. She knew what was going on. I mean, Prokofiev had a lot of cousins who were in serious difficulty. One was in prison in Moscow, and others were exiled. So he had a sense of what was going on. He just thought he could float above it as a celebrity. She was scared, rightly so. She went back, and immediately they began to see their freedoms being chipped away. She noticed people in the building they lived being arrested, and became very, very traumatic for her.
Well, you said that their marriage was stormy. Why was it stormy? Was he a good husband? Or was it her fault?
No, he was not a good husband. And the book, you know, a lot of people have complained that I sort of denounced the composer for this. But he on one hand, as I tried to argue, he made it quite clear that he was not, given his devotion to his craft and given the fact that he thought he was here on earth to actually serve that craft, that gift of his, that he was not going to be a particularly effective family man. He made that clear to her. He argued the point with her in letters, but she, you know, she persisted and actually believed that she could help him against some of his own worst instincts, and that was true. And so ultimately, she became pregnant and they got married as a result. But there was a match on a spiritual level the two of them had. But, you know, psychologically, emotionally, they were very much in different worlds.
Was he productive after he returned to Russia?
Incredibly. For the first few years, he composed at a Mozartian pace. He was that, you know, he was that inspired by being back.
And then World War II, and he becomes a composer, a patriotic composer.
Yeah, he always was patriotic. He loved Russia. He didn't necessarily love the Soviet system, but the war was the war. And he composed a lot of scores, which were just cartoonish, propagandistic things in support of the effort against the Nazis.
How did the war affect their lives?
But the war started, and just before the start of it, he walked out on her. Their marriage fell apart, and he fell into the company of a very young woman, a poet, a real Soviet product named Mira Mendelssohn, and he left her and lived with her in evacuation, leaving Lena behind in Moscow by herself with her sons.
My guest is Simon Morrison, who's written Lena and Serge, The Love and Wars of Lena Prokofiev. But they weren't allowed to divorce. Why weren't they allowed to divorce?
she didn't want the divorce. He tried through an intermediary, a friend, to actually approach her and ask her for permission to divorce, but she realized that if she lost that legal connection to him, she would be extremely vulnerable. And she fought against that. She resisted it. And then, in a strange and perverse turn of events in Soviet jurisprudence, it was deemed that because their marriage had taken place outside of the Soviet Union and had not been registered at a Soviet embassy, it was null and void. So the authorities actually declared Prokofiev a free man. And thus he was allowed eventually to, in the year that the months that Lena was arrested, he was able to go and marry somebody else.
Well, you've said that Lena was his muse. He lost her when they broke up. Would Mira serve well as a muse?
She was, I guess, a gatekeeper in the sense that she could, interpret Soviet reality for him. She helped him pick subjects for his dramatic works. She helped him with the libretto for War and Peace. But in terms of being a real spiritual or emotional inspiration, I don't think she was particularly effective. And it's fair to say, and this is a point of contention with some other people who work on Think About Prokofiev, it's fair to say from my perspective that his greatest works were all before the separation, and his talent actually dwindled afterwards.
Okay, so they're no longer married. She keeps custody of the kids. Why did the secret police suddenly start paying attention to her?
She, from the start of their relocation to the Soviet Union, she insisted on fraternizing and hanging out at the foreign embassies, American, British, even Japanese, French, any of them. She wanted that contact. She wanted that cosmopolitan life still. And so she was always on the radar of the authorities. And things tightened and loosened at different points in time under the Stalinist regime and after World War II, when she was alone in Moscow and the city was liberated, no longer under siege. She returned and she became far more insistent on making these contacts with foreigners, owing to the fact that a French neighbor of hers had managed to get out this way. And this was...
Was she hoping to leave?
She was desperately hoping to leave. She had a mother in France that she wanted to go to. Her mother was very, very old, infirm. This was the mother who raised her in Brooklyn. And she was desperate to see her, if only to visit her. And she petitioned and petitioned and petitioned, and that was just fateful. And Prokofiev told her, after their separation, what you were doing is not something I approve of, and it's something that will get you in deep trouble.
And she was arrested. What were the charges?
She was arrested for trying to leave, which, because she was a Soviet citizen, she was given citizenship. This was considered to be, she was, a treasonous. She was also accused of stealing documents, because during the war she did some translation work for the Red Army. She was accused of corresponding and contact with foreigners, which she had to admit to, and she was also accused of smuggling letters abroad for people through the embassies.
So did she give them a confession?
She was beaten into confessing.
Was there a trial?
There was a trial of 15 minutes.
And how long was she sentenced?
She was sentenced for 20 years, and she served 8 of them, and the reason why she only served 8 was Stalin died and the labor camps began to be dissolved.
She was sent to several prison camps over the course of the next 8 years, including one on the Arctic Circle.
Two of them were, one of them was right on the Arctic Circle, and then the other one was just below that. She spent 6 years up there. And then the last camp that she was at, which is quite southerly, it's only about 8 hours from Moscow, that camp, chillingly, because I went near it as far as I could get close to it, that camp is largely still in operation. And those two of the three ladies of that punk rock group, Pussy Riot, they're incarcerated there right now.
Did Serge ever go to visit her?
No.
So she was there. I imagine the conditions were horrifying. And she did she get any special treatment because she was the wife of one of the most famous composers of the Soviet Union?
She very cannily, I think, managed to insert herself into what are called cultural education activities in the camps. And so she was able to sing and teach some music and thus get sort of lesser workload. And basically, these camps were so appalling that the prisoners themselves had to build their own camps. So she suffered this greatly in the first couple of years of her sentence. She was in her 50s. It was difficult for her. She got very, very sick, almost died. But ultimately, she was able to get involved in singing and doing choruses and doing this propagandistic work, and that allowed her to live.
And Serge couldn't help her because Stalin turned on him.
Yes, sir. He was in political trouble from 1948, and he was very, very sick from a series of strokes. And I think he, through his sons, tried to get her some money and goods, but that's about all he did for her.
And then Stalin dies, and Serge dies on the same day.
Yeah, 2 hours apart, I think.
So he couldn't fight to get her out, but it took 2 years for her to get out after that?
Yeah, the camps still operated. Khrushchev came to power. He denounced elements of Stalinism, but these camps operated, and it was only, you know, after a few years of this bureaucratic process that certain camps began to be liquidated. I mean, these were the economic engines of the Soviet system, so keeping them going was important for the regime. And ultimately, her camp didn't get released. Her camp simply, like, dissolved around her. It just sort of collapsed, and she was sort of able to walk out of there.
Go back to Moscow, but not leave the country.
Not leave the country for, you know, 16 years.
She lived out her life after this traumatic experience, you say, with memory loss?
She suffered memory loss.
Well, she died at 90, didn't she, or something around
92, there? Yeah. Incredible life, obviously a very strong individual. And she gave interviews, and those interviews are horrific to listen to because there's tape recordings of them in which she basically just fixates on her forebears, her mother's family, you know, several generations. She just cannot even talk about the happy time she had with her husband. And she contradicts herself, and everything she says is about, you know, 50% correct. And you listen to them, you have to go and, you know, it was a real puzzle to try and figure out what exactly she was saying at times. Difficult to listen to those tapes.
You say you can never hear Sergei Prokofiev's music the same way since you've learned how he treated his wife.
I can't, mostly because when you learn what is happening around them politically or personally, for me, it inevitably informs how I hear the music. This, you know, I say that in a positive and negative way. I do think he treated her in an abhorrent way. But I also think that he suffered greatly as an artist, and that when I hear his music, I cannot help but hear all of the censorship and frustration and revision that was forced upon those works by other people.
Was his marriage to Mira Mendelssohn any better?
It was not a, you know, she was 24 years younger than he was. So it's not a spring-fall situation. I guess it would be like a January-November situation in terms of their age difference. She was essentially kept him alive. She was his support system. It was not a romance in a traditional sense.
Simon Morrison is a professor of music history at Princeton. He has written about Sergei Prokofiev's music and now about his marriage to the... it's a sad story that he has given the title Lena and Serge to, The Love and Wars of Lena Prokofiev. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks for the invitation.